Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This show, I talk with historian and educator Ron Inouye about the Japanese-American experience. In World War II, more than 100,000 Japanese-Americans, most of them U.S. citizens, were uprooted from their homes and communities and put in concentration camps.
On the local radio stations would be said, the Japs are coming, the Japs are coming. And then when they would get to the actual border, they'd have to be taken to the county seat or the next town to have their papers checked before they were allowed.
But in Alaska, Ron says the Japanese made contributions that go back to the early 19th century.
Well, it was actually Yankee whalers who found this group of six Japanese shipwreck guys and brought them to New Archangel, which is now what we call Sitka. And probably out of boredom, they made hand-drawn maps of what Sitka was like. And as far as we know, that's the first map that exists of New Archangel.
And Cotexa Clipping's Chris Lott explores some Japanese words that made it into our common usage. I hope you'll join us. The discussion about our country's immigration policy has sparked inflamed rhetoric. Perhaps the greatest outcry came with images of immigrant children being held in chain-link cages reminiscent of dog pens. Sadly, it isn't the first time we've caged those we perceived as other. In the 19th century, there was general anxiety about the so-called yellow peril. Landowners and industrialists welcomed cheap Asian labor to harvest sugarcane or build railroads. But these laborers faced exclusionary immigration policies and roadblocks to naturalization when they wanted to take part in the American dream. That xenophobia came to a head in World War II when President Roosevelt ordered Japanese Americans into concentration camps following the attack on Pearl Harbor. By some estimates, 120,000 men, women, and children of Japanese ancestry were uprooted from their homes and communities and placed in remote, hastily built camps. Most of the internees were U.S. citizens. My guest today had family members held in those camps, and he has helped document a part of the Japanese-American experience in Alaska. Ron Inouye is the co-author of Alaska's Japanese Pioneers. As you'll hear, he came to Alaska as an educator, served as an archivist, and is a passionate advocate of history and culture. I began by asking him what drew him north.
I graduated from college in 68. That was a time when there was a glut of people with degrees and there were no jobs. So I was raised on a farm in Colorado and I spent quite a bit of time there helping my folks. And so for two summers, I would work on the farm, and then I decided maybe I had to leave there. So I went to Portland, Oregon to join a friend who was starting a little business. And while I was there, I got involved with some people who were at Reed College, and I got a wonderful little Summer Danforth Foundation scholarship, essentially, to work on what was then the current issue of violence on campuses in America. And it was fascinating to be there and to be with that mix of people. And here I was, you know, I had very little income, working as a bartender then just to make ends meet. And sort of getting to enjoy that Portland environment quite a bit. But then one of the letters that I had shipped off to find a job ended up in Ketchikan. And I got this call, and I don't know how he traced me to my place in Portland, but he said, "Can you come up to Ketchikan? Because the guy who was supposed to be teaching isn't here, and we'd like to offer you that job." So within about 48 hours, I was headed to Ketchikan. And it was totally unknown to me. I had no idea where I was going. All I knew was that you had to either drive there and then get a ferry, or you could take a ferry out of Seattle and go directly. So I got in my old little Chevy, put everything I owned, which wasn't much, and headed up, and that was in 1970, and went to Ketchikan and came into the rainforest from dry, dry Colorado.
Well, I want to back up and ask you a couple of questions about that. Was your degree in teaching and education?
No, I had a composite that was actually in anthropology and sociology. So it was a really nice degree to have. And I had had some science in the previous and lots of music, too. So it was a pretty fortunate kind of degree to have because it allowed me to get into things that were of general interest. And when I got to Ketchikan, it was teaching in both sociology and anthropology.
But you say you grew up on a farm. Were any of your relatives inclined towards academics or studying these disciplines? What drew you to them?
My grandparents were Issei, the first generation of Japanese who came to this country. And they were essentially, on my father's side, very well educated. He was an attorney in Japan. But he ended up leaving the family and coming to the United States and ended up in Stockton, California. But he wasn't a very good farmer, which is primarily why he came there. He ended up working with a lot of other Japanese and was sort of head of the Japanese community in that Stockton area. And they had been interested in finding land for a lot of the other Japanese farmers who lived in the area. And there was a lot of land that was empty in Colorado and a lot of very, very eager land sellers who were recruiting all over. And I had no idea that they had not only recruited Japanese, but they had actually recruited Dutch people too. But the Japanese went and they took a look and they decided that that's where they wanted to put down roots. So there were probably about 10 or 15 Japanese families who, because of my grandfather, settled in that part of southern Colorado. And they essentially started the vegetable industry in that part of Colorado. It's very high altitude, very little disease, but no one had ever done that because it's primarily land that was settled originally by the Spanish. And then it was part of a Spanish land grant. Then it became Mexican. Then it became Texan. And then it became the United States. So the roots were very, very mixed. And had I not had all this anthropology and sociology, I wouldn't have known a lot of that kind of history. But that was on my grandfather, my father's side. My mother's side of the family, grandpa coming over to work on the railroad. So he ended up looking for land and was able to find a fairly large size piece in Rocky Ford, Colorado, where they grow a lot of wonderful watermelons. Great, great produce known globally. You know,
no kidding.
Running. Yeah. So that's sort of what that Issei generation did. But they were very, very avid about making sure their kids got educated. And so all of the boys, obviously, were pushed into college. The priority was always to give the males, the oldest male, the opportunity to get the education. And so that's what happened on my father's side. My father had just graduated from high school, and he was going to Denver University. And so he went to Denver, and then that's when my grandfather passed away. So he returned to the farm, and he was then responsible for taking care of the farm, raising his older sister and three younger brothers. So he lost out on his education, but he kept the farm going, and that's where I was raised.
Mm. In your book, Alaska's Japanese Pioneers, Faces, Voices, and Stories, that arc of coming into the country in Colorado eventually is mirrored in many of the people that you interviewed eventually. So was there a large Japanese community, Japanese American community in Colorado then when you were growing up?
Actually, you know, it's very parallel to what I found in Alaska. When you're a kid growing up, you know only what you know. And that was a small community in the San Luis Valley of about 10 to 15 Japanese families. And so we formed a community based on language. Sometimes we'd have Japanese school and they'd try to teach us Japanese and we rebelled, obviously. But we would have a Buddhist church and we would have all of these special holidays when we would gather, New Year's in particular. But we knew there were other Japanese in other parts of Colorado. And it turned out that there were ones in the Arkansas Valley, many in Denver, some on the western slope, but also other men like my grandfather in the Arkansas Valley who had decided they needed to stay in the United States. So they married local women, usually not Japanese because there were no Japanese women. And so there were isolated individuals like that. And that, I think, was a pretty interesting pattern. Subsequently, I hadn't realized that that group of people leaving Japan during that time period was very major. We only know the ones who came to the United States. There were others who went to Mexico, to Brazil, essentially all over. And when I retired, one of the things that I did to sort of celebrate the fact was I went to South America. And I was shocked to see Jose Yamamoto. And there were so many people with Japanese names who were like me, second and third generation removed. And I found them in Brazil. I found them in Argentina. There are huge populations in Mexico. And they have an organization that meets every 2 years now of Pan-American Nikkei, people who have originated from Japan. And it's fascinating to meet your counterparts and to see what they're doing to try to preserve their language and to preserve their culture. And it's not unlike what a lot of Alaska Native groups are doing now. They have language schools. They have cultural presentations. They're trying to preserve food, recipes, or recordings. And it's all because they see themselves now blending into becoming Brazilians and Argentinians. And we even had sort of a case with a sort of dictator in South America. So we see that the Japanese have integrated in some cases with the native populations and in other cases have not. But in that part of South America, you also see tremendous numbers of Germans and Italians.
That's historian and educator Ron Inouye, and you're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. After this short break, World War II and the forced relocation of Japanese Americans. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This segment, I'm talking with Ron Inouye. He's president of the Tanana Yukon Historical Society and the co-author of Alaska's Japanese Pioneers. Let's return to our discussion.
Given our current political wrangling over immigration, Asian Americans got a mixed message about coming to the United States. They were brought over for laborers, but then when they bought land or they were really thriving in certain communities, there were laws passed to restrict them. And eventually there was a quota placed on how many Asian Americans and Japanese Americans could come to the United States. And finally, in World War II, of course, Japanese Americans are put away. Did your family experience any of those things?
Yes, we did. My family was interesting in that while they were living in Colorado before the war, they had established themselves on the farm, and I think people knew them fairly well and accepted them in that community. However, my grandmother was starting to have some heart problems, so the doctor recommended that they go to a lower altitude. So they went back to California, but they lived in Los Angeles. And the only job my dad could get was being a gardener, you know, all the stereotypes. Well, it turned out that as the war was evolving, he was a gardener for the LA County Sheriff. And the sheriff knew that this process of evacuation was going to happen. And he sort of suggested that if my dad had a place to go, he might want to consider going before the evacuation happened. So my dad gathered the family together, and they had everything they had on a truck and a car. And they went back to Colorado. It must have been an awful experience because my uncles have told me different versions of the same story. But as they were traveling across California and going into Arizona and into New Mexico, they would be followed by the equivalent of the state police or the state patrol. On the local radio stations would be said, the Japs are coming, the Japs are coming. And so people would sort of line the streets and sort of watch. And then when they would get to the actual border, they would be formally stopped by the patrol of the next state. They'd have to be taken to the county seat or the next town to have their papers checked before they were allowed. Whenever there was a bridge across a major river, they were instructed to keep the windows rolled up, and they were not allowed. People were afraid that they would be doing something evil. So that happened as they went all the way across. Whenever they needed gasoline or anything, everything had to be very carefully done. They went across into Colorado, and at the border, there was a state trooper waiting for them. And they figured, well, here we go again. So they stopped, and the trooper got out and said, on behalf of the state of Colorado, welcome. And they were just really befuddled because that was the same county where they had had their farm. Well, subsequently, we learned that the governor, Ralph Carr, had been a very, very strong advocate for welcoming Japanese. He was one of the only states that wanted them back. And as a result of that, he lost the next election. But it's just within the last 5 years, that section of Highway 285 from the New Mexico border into Colorado is called the Ralph Carr Memorial Highway. And he has been memorialized for the stand that he took on that issue. And within the Japanese community, there's a fairly major park at Sakura Square in Denver next to the Buddhist temple. And there's a major statue of Ralph Carr and others who were active in the Japanese community. But it's interesting that he took the hit.
Yeah.
But finally, he's getting some recognition for the stand that he was able to take.
Boy, the whole sorry history really underscores the folly of human conduct. Was your family put in one of the relocation camps?
Well, my parents and two uncles were back on the farm when the actual evacuation order came, so they were okay. My aunt had married, and she was married to a guy who was from Los Angeles. They had a family there, so they were evacuated. And interestingly enough, they were shipped to a camp in Colorado, to Amachi. And it was one of the smallest of the camps that were essentially east of the Rocky Mountains, which is where they were situated. And I found it interesting that my parents would talk about getting in the car and driving quite a while to get up to see their relatives. And my cousin, who was in one of the camps, talks about being visited and how much they really enjoyed seeing family again. But there are pilgrimages back to a lot of those camps like Amachi. And every year there's a delegation from Denver who go to visit that. And the Alaskans were in Minidoka, Idaho. And I think their story is a very interesting one too, because these were Japanese who really, like the ones in Colorado, lived only in their small community. So they didn't know a lot about the other Japanese in other parts of the state. Southeast, however, was sort of different because that's where all of the ships came. Ketchikan was the first town in this going north. And so they pretty much knew a lot of the Japanese in Southeast. And there were significant numbers in Juneau and in Sitka and in Petersburg. And so they knew each other. But the ones who were isolated or, let's say, more adventurous here in the Fairbanks area or in Anchorage weren't really that well known, and they had really no reason to know each other because they were so geographically spread out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the reason that people were so isolated, and there was no real way that they could feel they could do anything as a group because they were in isolation.
Mm.
And I think that's true of any group that is being, well, persecuted in a sense because they don't feel like they have any rights. And if you don't have citizenship, then you certainly have no rights. And if you screw up, then that's more reason they're going to toss you out. And I think the Japanese were interesting in that the Issei, the first generation, were barred from citizenship, essentially. But their children were born in this country, so they were American citizens. And because they were American citizens and education was so valuable to them, a lot of them were university educated. Many of them were attorneys. And they were the ones who really turned the tide when this business of redress or reparations for internment became an issue.
They lost property, and in some cases, until official reparations were achieved, they lost a lot.
It varied a lot. It really varied a lot. In Juneau, in Ketchikan, oftentimes the Japanese were prominent, so they knew lawyers and attorneys and bankers who helped them and took over the control of their property. So when they came back, they had something to return to. A lot of the others had no idea about such legal things, and they left it over to their neighbors or to former employees who essentially ransacked the property or took it over, essentially. So it really varied on who was overseeing that. When reparations actually occurred, which with a formal apology from the U.S. government, they were given a set amount of money for the survivors who returned, but it was a very minuscule amount per capita relative to the actual property losses that they would have lost during that war period.
Mm-hmm. Did your family, was it a difficult experience? Did they carry any rancor from that process, from that period? And how did your family process that emotionally?
Even within the family, it was very awkward to talk about the camps. They would generally talk and they would tell funny stories, but never the ones that were more sad, the ones that were more telling. Maybe they talked amongst themselves, but not with the kids around. I found it interesting that whenever I would meet a group of Japanese Americans anyplace, the first thing they would ask me is, what camp were you? That was their way of figuring out who you were, where your family came from. And they could fill in that history because that was common experience for that second generation of Japanese Americans. I happened to be at a Japanese American Citizens League conference in Seattle at the university. And it was at the time redress was being initiated through Congress. And I was staying in the dorm and I went down to have breakfast with all these people and I had no clue who they were. And the first question that I asked was, what camp are you from? And I told them I was not. Well, they asked then, who are your relatives and what camp were they? And I told them my name, what camp my aunt had been in, and I'd say within a half hour, they knew more about my family history than I knew about it because it was such a tightly knit community and it was very inwardly turned too because they looked to each other for mutual support. They belonged to the same sports groups, the same churches. And even after they left California, they still maintained that kind of tie to one another. And that, unfortunately, is not something that's continued on into the third generation, the Sansei, which is what I am. And then the Yonsei, the next generation, because there's been so much so-called outmarriage. And as a result, I have a difficult time dealing with my own family history and with my cousins who don't really know any of this history. And right now, they don't seem to care. But obviously, for those of us that are in this transition period, it's important.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with historian and educator Ron Inouye. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. Let's continue with my conversation with award-winning historian Ron Inouye.
I want to get you to Fairbanks. We left you in Ketchikan. How did you get north?
Well, I had a wonderful time in Ketchikan. Everything was totally new, and my learning curve was so steep, it was just about fell over on itself. I was adopted, essentially, by Willard and Mary Jones, a wonderful, wonderful Clinkett Haida Simshan family. He taught diesel mechanics at the college. But about the second day that I was there, Willard said, you're going to come to a dance Saturday. And I thought, what the hell is this about? Well, we went and it was at the A&B Hall, Alaska Native Brotherhood. And he introduced me to Native people in Ketchikan. And it was the most inviting, most wonderful experience I've ever had. And because of that, I was able to learn so much from lots of different perspectives. You know, the anthropologists have their viewpoint in their literature, but then you get to see how current societies exist and how they do things. And it was wonderful to then be introduced to, well, Selena Paratovich, who was the major weaver in Southeast, wonderful Haida lady, who took me under her wing. And every Saturday I would go to her house and she would tell me stories and sit there and weave. And Nathan Jackson was a wonderful, wonderful carver. And he lived down the road from me. And so we would get together periodically. And it was just a wonderful experience being there. However, the rain in Ketchikan was a little wearing for me. And I had been interested in coming to Fairbanks because it was the main campus. And Dr. Wood, bless his heart, would come down and he would visit all of the campuses. He would do that once a year. And I respected him so much because he had read about who we were, what we were teaching. He knew my name. He asked how my classes were going. And he always told me about what Fairbanks was like. And I was really curious at that point. And Ted Ryberg was head of the library, and he would make his annual rounds. And those were the only two people that connected us with Fairbanks. Mm. But I wanted so desperately for our kids in Ketchikan to feel like they were part of a bigger system than just a little dinky community college. So I wrote to the Polar Star, the Sun Star folks, and they started shipping down the campus newspaper. Oh. So every week we would have them there. And it was really wonderful to start building that relationship with Fairbanks.
How did the kids respond?
They were really, really interested. Because if you live in Southeast, your orientation is always to Seattle. It's south. That's where all the TV came, the newspapers came there, the weather came there. All the kids wanted to go to the University of Washington or, well, to Portland. And so the whole mindset was never north. And it just sort of befuddled me. But then I subsequently have remembered how Dr. Bunnell used to make those trips down to Southeast to recruit students. And he really worked very hard to go down there so that they would get some Southeast students coming up north. And, you know, that's been a continuing battle. But the real change, I think, has been the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Oh. All of a sudden, there was this other dimension that came. And all of a sudden, the corporations were all north. They had authority. They had really strong political support. They had an identity that didn't exist outside. And so people started going to AFN conventions. They had all kinds of things that drew them north rather than just south. And I think it's just marvelous that we have that vehicle now for students to be thinking about using their scholarships in state. And thank goodness we have decent programming to track them. Because before, I don't think we did. We were just an ordinary, regular kind of school like any other school.
Sure.
But it's been wonderful to see that happen. And it's good that, that did occur. But while I was there in Ketchikan, I got to work on a number of committees, and I got to know more people who were up north. In fact, it was interesting. The first year I was in Ketchikan, the Alaska Airlines had one of those wonderful tours to Russia through the university, and I took it. And I got to meet people who were part of the Anchorage and Fairbanks campuses. And we had a marvelous time going through, you know, well, even the places like Tashkent and Samarkand, as well as the traditional Russian locations. And then I was working with the task force for the Humanities Forum. And so I got to meet a bunch of academics through that route. And ultimately, I was offered a position up here when the Ford Foundation had been dealing with all the creation of the rural educational attendance areas, and they needed some people to come up and start working with essentially not just the creation had already been done, but figuring out curriculum and how to train school board members so that they would know what the responsibilities were. So I happened to know Joe Sanungatuk, who was on the Humanities Forum board, and he was up here. So a bunch of us just sort of reformed once I got up into Fairbanks.
Oh, great.
It was wonderful. I got to travel all over the state dealing with the new school districts. And it was quite, I got to see the state in a way that very few other people do. And to make friendships across the state was very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when I first met you in 83, you were with the Rasmussen Library, right?
Right.
How did you get that into that position?
Well, like the situation that we have now, when funding runs out, Ford Foundation, the university was in the doldrums at that point, so a lot of us lost our jobs. And I ended up doing some consulting for a while, and then I started doing some work with Bill Schneider on oral history and had a marginal affiliation with the university, helping out where I could with that. I subsequently went to school deciding that I would use my time. So I went to Cambridge, the Scott Polar Research Institute. They're the only ones that at that time had a polar emphasis. So I went and went into their polar studies program and had a wonderful, wonderful experience in Cambridge and in London, actually. But I got that credential and I came back. And at that point, the library was looking for someone to do some indexing on polar issues. So that's where I came back and worked on the database. And what we were essentially trying to do was to capture the so-called gray material, the material that doesn't make it into the standard journals.
Mm.
And certainly all of Alaska is like that because we index things like the old Alaska magazine, the old Alaska journals, things that were in local newspapers that were significant. And so we did a lot of the grunt work that's now being automated. But it was source material that otherwise would never have seen the light of day that we thought was important and that I think still continues to be important.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with historian and educator Ron Inouye. When we return from this short break, documenting family history. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking right now with historian Ron Inouye. He's president of the Tanana-Yukon Historical Society and the co-author of Alaska's Japanese Pioneers. Let's return to our discussion.
I guess the first thing that got me started was living in Ketchikan and meeting the Ohashi family. They ran a little store. It was like an ice cream store, but a general store. And I got to meet Mr. and Mrs. Ohashi, who were really, really interesting for their experiences of having been one of the first businesses in Ketchikan. And I think until about 7 or 8 years ago, when that business officially sold, they were probably one of the oldest continuously operating businesses in Ketchikan and I think in Alaska. I would go there and eat ice cream and talk to the Ohashis, and they would tell me these stories. And so I got very interested in talking to them and the other folks. And in 1973, I got a National Endowment for the Humanities summer stipend of, I think, about $1,000 or so. But that allowed me to spend time in the library, going through all of the old newspapers documenting what happened to the Japanese Americans during that World War II period. And that's what really laid the baseline for what I came to understand as being a larger issue. And it was really fun sitting there going through old microfilm newspapers of what it was like when you have someone in Fort Yukon reacting to the fact that someone in their community was going to be evacuated, someone who was half Japanese and half Alaska Native, never seen another Japanese American or Japanese, but he was being evacuated. And people in Seward who had been running businesses there for many, many years. And it was sort of telling that a lot of the marshals who had to arrest these people were actually good friends.
Mm.
So you get those really, really poignant stories as well mm-hmm. as more of the statistical announcements and numbers of people who were evacuated. But that's what initially got me interested. And then later we decided that we wanted to do something more formal. So Carol Hoshko was working with the University of Alaska in Anchorage. And Kazumi Hishiki was running a Japanese language school in Anchorage, and we needed someone who could translate from Issei. So the three of us were working to capture the few remaining Issei who had memories of that time period. And I think since we did that work, just about all of the people are gone now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad we were able to capture what we did get. But what was more interesting to me was to see what happened after the Japanese left Alaska. Very few returned. Many of them had more opportunities outside, but they still had that remembrance of what it was like to have been raised in Alaska. And so that was very, very dear to their hearts. And I think there's been a subsequent project in Juneau called the Empty Chair Project, which honors the Tanaka family. John was a high school senior the year that the family was evacuated, and he was scheduled to be the valedictorian. But the internment notices had come out, and so they were going to be removed before there was a graduation. So the community in the school of Juneau had a ceremony, and they graduated John, and he got his diploma, and then the family got evacuated. But during the actual graduation ceremonies at Juneau High School, they had an empty chair on the stage to commemorate him. And that was the community's outpour of interest and acknowledgement. Well, fast forward another 50 years, and relatives of the Tanakas and some of the people in Juneau who knew that story decided they had to do something about that. So they put together a nice sculpture of an empty chair that sits in a little park right above Capitol, the Alaska State Capitol. And it was dedicated about 3 years ago. There's a wonderful book out about it. And I think that chair is very symbolic. But it's been about the only real memorial there is to that time period. And I'm glad that it's there. And it represents, I think, the community of Juneau's efforts to memorialize that event and to acknowledge it publicly and to embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of Juneau people know that story.
Well, the Japanese experience in Alaska is kind of richer for a number of reasons. I was so surprised to find Russians discovered shipwrecked Japanese sailors on an island in the southeast way back in the early 19th century.
That's right. You know, when the Japanese chose to isolate themselves, their technology died, essentially, because they had no idea about the change in construction of ships. So when they started shipping, they were out in these old boats that were very, very inferior. The rest of the world had moved on, and they hadn't. But you take a look at the way the world is organized and the Pacific Gyre, and you realize that that is the natural flow of currents. So many of them would leave Japan, and then they get shipwrecked. Well, it was actually Yankee whalers who found this group of six Japanese shipwreck guys and brought them to New Archangel, which is now what we call Sitka. But at that point, that was the major West Coast city for all of North America, because there was no San Francisco. There was nothing in California. Sitka was the center of the Western coast. And it was there that these Japanese were sort of bored because they wanted to go back to Japan, but there was no way to go until another ship would come by that would take them. So they spent, I think, about 6 months. And probably out of boredom, perhaps, they made hand-drawn maps of what Sitka was like. And as far as we know, that's the first map that exists of what New Archangel was really like.
Mm.
But eventually, you know, they made that journey back to Japan. They had to go, I think they went to Kamchatka, and then from Kamchatka, then were taken south back to Japan.
And during the gold rush, most of us have heard, and of course now I can't think of his name.
That's Junji Nawada. Yeah.
Exactly. So even those of us not familiar with the Japanese experience in Alaska will know his name because he appears in a number of accounts.
He was here at the founding of Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a cook for Barnett, or Barnett, as Terrence Cole would correct me now. But he was an adventurer, and I think one of those people that is fascinating for his dog meshing ability. But his work essentially was pretty well commemorated, I think, in two of the major dog sled races now. He was responsible for getting word of the Fairbanks Gold Rush to the Yukon. And some say it was because he was bribed to bring all of those Yukoners into Fairbanks. But nonetheless, the route that he took is essentially what we have for the Yukon Quest. He was also hired by the Seward Commercial Company at the time when Seward was competing with Cordova for the routes up into the North Country. And what Wada did was he connected a lot of the existing trails between the villages so that they could go from Seward all the way up into Nome. And what we have now is the Iditarod is sort of a motley conglomeration of Sirim Ran and a lot of other things. But he's acknowledged now, at least through the National Park Service, for having been one of the major establishers of that route. So there were people like that, and Frank Yasuda, who came from the North Slope, and with his wife, Nevelo, an Eskimo, got the town of Beaver going commercially, because it was at the time of the Chandelier Gold Rush that became a commercial center. So there were people like that who were here. I tend to think there were a lot more single Japanese men who were in the country. And I think many of them probably married Alaska Native women. But we don't know much about them except through some of the names. In Deering, for instance, there's a Moto family. And we assume that that was a shortening of the name Yamamoto. Oh. There's a family in Cordova who are called Fudi, F-O-O-D-E, and the original was probably Fuji, F-U-J-I. And in Sitka, there's an Ozawa family, and I think theirs was originally Ozawa, but they now are known as Ozawas. So you see a lot of changes in names. And what was fascinating to me at the time that the redress issue was emerging, I was on campus and I would get queries from a lot of younger students who would want to know about the Japanese sides of their families, because before there hadn't been very much publicity about that. And all of a sudden there was a great curiosity of, you know, who are Japanese and could I possibly be one of those people? So it takes a lot of reasons, I guess, for people to start looking at their own family histories.
That's historian and educator Ron Inoue. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the Japanese-American experience in Alaska, among other things. When we return from this break, the value of culture. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking right now with historian Ron Inoue. Let's return to our conversation.
Well, the other aspect about the Japanese experience in Alaska, we haven't talked about the relocation effort and the Aleuts that were also impacted because of that, was the invasion of the Aleutian Islands by Japan during World War II.
That's correct. The bombing of Dutch Harbor.
Yeah, that's right. And so in some fundamental way, the influence of Japan and Japanese Americans is a larger element than I think we customarily credit.
Well, I'd say the population of Japanese and Japanese Americans in Alaska is so minuscule that they're not given recognition because they are so small. When the Commission on Wartime Relocation was having its hearings, I intentionally got information about the Alaska Japanese to that commission in Washington, D.C., because I wanted them to talk about Alaska Japanese and Japanese Americans. It didn't make the final report. Mm. However, there were hearings of that commission in Anchorage and Unalaska and in St. Paul. And so there was some discussion about the Japanese Americans, but obviously at that point they were more interested in the Aleuts and their story. And I think it's really wonderful that we had Senator Ted Stevens being good friends with Senator Dan Inouye from Hawaii, because it was Senator Stevens who knew the Aleut story. And Inouye was obviously very much interested in the Japanese-American portion of that. I'm sure it was Senator Stevens who told Inouye about the Aleuts, so they were included in the study of that commission. And as a result, a number of very well-educated people on that hearing commission came to Alaska and had those three hearings, and they got to hear the Aleut story too. It's an odd set of circumstances, but I'm beginning to find that that's really what it is. It's being ready at the time when the opportunity arises,
right,
and always being prepared, because you never know when what you know can make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, you tell them and they won't include it. So it works the other way too.
Well, I want to talk about more contemporary issues you've taken up. You seem to be a strong proponent of history, of culture. And in the early days when I was here at KUAC, you helped produce a storytelling program on KUAC, the Northern Storyteller.
Right.
So what drives Ron about these efforts?
Two things that were really important to me growing up were libraries and museums, because they were the places where you could find things that you couldn't find anywhere else that were pretty authoritative. And they told stories in ways that we would never otherwise know. And so those two have always been very important. That's why I continue my interests with libraries and museums. Music has always been fun because of the way that I came to music as a kid.
How was that?
Piano lessons. Boring piano lessons.
As so many of us, yes.
But what was wonderful is that I had such wonderful teachers. My first teacher was a nun. And Sister Hillary, bless her, was so patient with me. But I would take my lessons in the sister house. And in this little town of Kapolin, Colorado, the public school was run by nuns. I had no idea. I thought there was always a separation of church and state, except in these poorer counties in Colorado, the church ran the schools. There was no religion involved, obviously. But she happened to be a teacher, and she also taught piano. So I would go over to the sister house, and while I was waiting there for my lesson, I would hear the nuns chanting and giving their music. And I was just fascinated with that because it sort of paralleled the chanting, this chanting that I heard as a child growing up in a Buddhist church. Obviously, that was not in Japanese, and I had no idea what the words were. It was just chanting. But they were both chanting in different ways. And that sort of always fascinated me with how music and how ritual is so much a part of life. But subsequently, I had wonderful teachers for piano. I had, in the little college where I graduated, there was a piano department that was very, very good. And one of the first teachers was a Russian lady. She was a white Russian. She had fled Russia. She ended up teaching at the conservatory in Rio de Janeiro. She wanted to come to the United States, so she ended up in this little town in Colorado teaching at the college, and I happened to be one of the students she took on the side because I wasn't a college student at that point. But she was so enthusiastic about music, and she was of the Russian school, you know, very rigorous, but just a marvelous teacher, and you died to make her, to please her. And then I later had an instructor who had studied under Rudolf Ganz. Very, very rigorous teacher, sort of an eccentric, but he was really devoted to his music. And I think it's because of those kinds of personalities that you really are drawn, not just to the music, but to interpretation and to other things like that. And that's what's fascinating about music or literature or anything. It's what you bring to it and then what others help you to understand and then where you take it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
Are there any projects today that you are involved with?
Oh, yeah. It's really fun. I enjoy so much working with Vera Alexander, who retired from the university.
Another pianist.
And we, after our college Rotary meetings on Monday, play two piano. And it's really great fun to go back to old stuff and to read new stuff and to reread things that we knew previously, but to reinterpret. But it's really, I think, very stimulating, not because you have to please yourself, but because you're obligated with the other person. So you have a double mission. You know, it's not just your responsibility. It's your responsibility to the...
You really have to listen and respond.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I think that's part of the whole process of doing things. That's why I love jazz so much. And you think about how jazz works as a way where you start with a theme and then everyone does a variation on it, their own interpretation. But you always revert back to what the original theme was. And I think that's what's interesting about many things, is that we have a theme someplace. And we can play lots of different variations on it, but there is a theme there someplace. We just got to find it.
Well, you know, for me, given the divisive nature of so much of what's occupying the news these days, I really find solace in a beautiful piece of music, well performed. It gives you a respite to that discourse, but it also opens up that there is another perspective on the world and the creative efforts of humankind.
Well, I think we live in a very interesting and fortunate time. Those of us that are part of this boomer generation have lived through a wonderful time when all ships were raised, the global economics, the conditions after the war, unfortunately, was when the economies boomed. But we've been fortunate to, we've lived through good times, we've had relatively good educations, everyone's lived at a fairly high standard. And I marvel at the training of all these young students who are musicians now. The quality of musicianship is just phenomenal. And we're so fortunate to be a part of that. I also think that we're a part of human history where there are lots of people now who all have different points of view. And we all want to be assertive about who we are and what we believe. And gosh darn, I'm going to have my opinion because that's what liberation was about in the 60s. You know, you assert yourself and you stand up for what you think is right. Well, there's a lot of dissonance there too. But you take a look historically and you realize that these things have happened before. They will happen again. It's part of the maturation process. And that's why I wonder about the role of education and what you can take forward with you in terms of values and moral beliefs versus what you have to live and experience that is a part of you. And so I think education is being challenged. I think religion is being challenged. I think philosophy is being challenged, political systems. And I don't know if there's a shortcut through all of that. I think that's maybe a part of human nature. But it's tough when you have very strong beliefs in all directions and others don't necessarily believe that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, Ron Inouye, I want to thank you so much for coming down and talking with me today.
Well, it's been fun.
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Support for Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. When we return from the break, some Japanese words that are part of our everyday speech and some that should be. It's Chris Lott and Cachexia Clippings. Here's Chris.
English is a relatively young language that sports, on top of a base of 20 to 30% native words derived from Old English, a well-deserved reputation for frequent and liberal borrowing from other languages, most obviously French, Latin, Old Norse, Dutch, and Greek. But while borrowings from many thousands of other languages, large and small, from Chinese, Arabic, and Hindi to the over 800 languages spoken in Papua New Guinea alone, may account for a small percentage of English words, they comprise a practically endlessly diverse and fascinating group. Consider Japanese, which, counting by native speakers, sits just inside the top 10 most common languages worldwide. Many of the Japanese words we have tucked into our English pockets are obviously of Japanese origin. Would you like some sushi or tofu with that emoji? But even some of the obvious terms have less obvious etymologies that add richness to our linguistic tapestry. Karaoke, for example, doesn't mean terrible drunken singing of nostalgic songs, as I might have guessed based on my own experiences, but is a combination of the kanji, the symbol, for empty, and in one of those etymological twists that makes words so much fun, the katakana, the syllabic rendering, of the English word orchestra, making our borrowing of karaoke, the empty orchestra, partially a borrowing back of a loan given. Yakuza, both the blanket term for Japanese organized crime and the criminal members of those organizations, is the combination of the Japanese numbers ya, 8, ku, 9, and za, 3, or the worst hand possible in oichokabu, a baccarat-like gambling game. Thus, the word Yakuza simultaneously involves both the bad luck of one who finds themselves in opposition to them, as well as the immense skill it takes for a player to draw this hand in the famous game and still win. Kamikaze, for many synonymous with suicide pilot, literally means divine wind, and originally referred to a typhoon that, according to Japanese legend, rose up and saved Japan from Kublai Khan's Mongol invasion in 1281. And that leads us to some surprising, at least to me, borrowings. That word typhoon is ultimately derived from the Chinese dai feng, from da, big, plus fang, wind, and forms of it are found in Portuguese, Urdu, and Arabic, but its Japanese rendering as taifu is likely the most influential on our English word. The similar sounding, but thanks to F. Scott Fitzgerald's unfinished novel Oh So American to My Ears word tycoon, comes to us from the Japanese taikun, T-A-I-K-U-N, or great prince. Though it has a similar Chinese origin, combining the same da for big or great, plus jun, prince. Perhaps it's just my ears and experiences, but some other words that sounded quintessentially American or English to my ears turn out to be direct borrowings from the Japanese. Honcho, as in the proverbial head honcho, the big kahuna, the boss, is the Japanese word honcho, H-A-N-C-H-O, or group leader. And skosh, which I associate with the best of the recipes passed down by word of mouth that always seem to need a pinch of this or a skosh of that, comes from the Japanese sukoshi, a little bit. Finally, mostly in the oft-mislabeled untranslatable category, there are some Japanese words that we should be borrowing more often for their succinct expression of actions and feelings familiar to us all. Sundoku is the act of accumulating piles of unread books, a term I much prefer to the possibly more clinically accurate term for my own bookish obsession, hoarding. A combination of tsumu, to pile up, and doku, to read, sundoku is also a pun, because the phrase sunde oku means to pile up and leave. As spring springs and summer hastens in, even Alaskans have an opportunity to experience komorebi, or sunlight coming through the leaves of trees. A combination of words for tree, sun, and leaking or coming through, komorebi is a form of what you might call in English crepuscular rays, or God's rays. And closely related is shinrin-yoku, or walking through a forest and enjoying the green light, which in Japanese is literally forest bathing. When I'm not lucky enough to be out enjoying the forest for the trees and I get caught at home by the dreaded drop-in, even the insulation of my piles of unread books might not be enough. That's when asuru comes in handy. A combination of residence and absence, asuru is the act of pretending not to be at home when someone is at the door, a time-honored activity of introverts everywhere. As one who's prone to nostalgia of both the brightening and wallowing kinds, the Japanese notion of natsukashi is appealing. Another of those so-called untranslatables, natsukashi is literally defined as desired, beloved, or missed, but it's both more specific and deeper than those. Natsukashi is the feeling of the past being happily evoked through a specific experience, place, or object. Natsukashi is being suddenly immersed in a memory, the feeling of yes, I remember that, when tasting a favorite childhood candy, or time traveling upon hearing that song you once played on repeat for days or weeks but haven't heard again since. Natsukashi is a happy feeling, the kind of nostalgia to be cherished when it washes over and through you, and it necessarily happens fleetingly and unexpectedly. Lastly, a related phrase and concept I, along with so many others, have thought about and explored for a long time, mono no aware. Literally a combination of mono, thing, and aware, an expression of surprise, an awe or an oh that can be translated as a deep feeling, a pathos, and an awareness. And a staple concept in Buddhist thought, mono no aware is the sudden, bittersweet awareness of the transience of things. In Japan, and on many streets around me in the Pacific Northwest right now, one can see the prototypical object or trigger of mono no aware, the suddenly emergent, all too quick to fall cherry blossoms. Every year that I am fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time, seeing those beautiful blossoms appear as if by magic, knowing they will soon be carpet beneath my feet and then gone altogether, I am hit with the full force of mono no aware. In that moment, I experience sudden clarity in understanding one of the common, less formal definitions of that exhilarating, simultaneous rise and fall of feeling of mono no aware as experiencing at once the awness of things. For more on these borrowings, as well as some I couldn't fit into today's show, and a blanket apology for my pronunciation of Japanese and pretty much every other language, or to listen to any other Kotexic word segment, saddle up your favorite browser and mosey on over to kotexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this week's Northern Soundings. You can find us on iTunes and the KUAC website. I'm Robert Hannon. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.